This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, we're talking about sensory-friendly performances. Before we jump into this episode, I want to take a moment to express my gratitude. Last week, WRAL announced its 2019 Viewer's Choice Award winners. RDU on Stage received honorable mention for Best Blog, and you all voted me as Best Podcaster. I cannot begin to tell you how overwhelmed and surprised I was to receive this award. The support of this community means the world to me. You guys will never know how much. And I will try my best to live up to your high expectations and keep bringing you great conversation and interviews week after week. Thank you. Keep listening. And please support your local theater, like the folks at Raleigh Little Theater, who I am chatting with on this episode. So, those of you who know me or have listened to this podcast know that I'm an advocate for sensory-friendly performances and experiences. My daughter has autism, and as a mom, I know how important these experiences are to families, mainly because when my daughter was little, there were no sensory-friendly anything. We had to create our own hacks and literally hope for the best when we took her out to crowded public places. And I can't tell you how many people would stop and stare and pass judgment if she had a meltdown or misbehaved, making my husband and I feel like the worst parents in the world. Johanna Maynard Edwards, who many of you know is the executive director of the Women's Theater Festival, she can relate to what I'm talking about. She brought her young son to a performance of James and the Giant Peach at Raleigh Little Theater a few years ago, and it didn't quite go as planned. But as you will hear, it's the way that Raleigh Little Theater and artistic director Patrick Torres, executive director Charles Vanoff, and education director Meredith Peterson Cooper responded following that incident that truly turned a negative into a positive. And that is where our conversation begins. Here's Johanna to start things off.
At the time, I had been teaching here for many years, a proud RLT teaching artist, and I was so excited to bring him to his first show. And we did all of the autism parent things. We had a pre-show book where we did a little social story about what was going to happen. And he had been to this building on many occasions because I work here. And he, I think at that point, he had taken a class or a camp. And we got here nice and early so he could have a tour of the theater. We brought his water and his fidgety things and all the things he would need to enjoy the show. I specifically chose a seat to the side and near the back so that if we had to leave, we could. And I had a crisp $20 bill in my back pocket for the person who sat in front of him at the show so that in case he was kicking the seat or talking too much, I could say, "Congratulations, you helped an autistic person enjoy their first time at the theater. You're amazing. Great job." But halfway through the show, he was vocalizing a lot. And he was hopping on his seat a lot. And maybe in retrospect, I got him here too early and he had too much time of pre-seating. But this is what autism parents do. We like second guess everything that went wrong. What could I have done to make this outcome different? But halfway through the show, an older patron stood up and came over and loudly yelled at me and suggested that my child shouldn't be here and that it was inappropriate for me to have brought him here. And it was a children's show. But because of the relationship I have with the people here, and that technically this was my employer, I didn't feel like an empowered advocate. I felt like I shouldn't make waves in the moment. I shouldn't affect what could be, you know, income or make trouble for this company. I can handle that on the back end. But in the meantime, I was totally devastated because it was really important to me that my child felt at home at RLT. When I was growing up, I wanted to be an RLT theater kid, and my parents didn't take me. I wound up going to Governor School and then NYU with other kids from Raleigh who grew up here. And when I moved back, one of the first things I did was submit my resume to work here. And when I had him, I'm like, I can't wait for him to come. So it all those things were kind of just crashing and swirling around me, and he didn't know why we had to leave. And Charles happened to be walking up the stairs as we were exiting the theater. And the look on his face was so, I felt even worse for him than I did for me or for Liam at the time, because he didn't know what to do or how to fix it. He said all the right things. Can I reaccommodate you? That's literally what you do in those moments. But I just didn't want to make anything worse.
So Charles, after this experience, I think there are a lot of companies that might turn a blind eye or say, you know, gosh, we hope this never happens again, but you guys didn't. So at what point did the conversation start to begin making accommodations for people and families with disabilities?
I guess a lot of it kind of goes back to in 2013, we did some work on our mission statement. And before that, we had had this kind of generic mission statement at Raleigh Little Theater. And there was nothing wrong with it, but it was like, we provide an excellent theater experience. And it's like, well, you know, everybody wants to be excellent, right? And hopefully we are. But the work that we did with the staff and the board, and with some feedback from other stakeholders too, is that we really wanted to focus on we are a welcoming place that uses theater to educate, you know, entertain, engage, enrich audiences. And so I think that's really kind of foundational to all of this, that we, you know, see theater as a vehicle, as a tool. It's not a means in and of an end, you know, and of course we are a theater, it is the point, but you know what I mean? It's not just about producing theater. So that was some of the foundational work in 2013. And then really, we've been kind of tossing around the idea of doing sensory friendly for a while. And I honestly don't, it's like, man, trying to find that exact moment where it first, I don't know when it was, but it was before James and the Giant Peach. By the time James and the Giant Peach came along, we already either had a tentative or a firm date to do it the following season. And so a lot of the other kind of foundational pieces that came together was, and of course we were doing other kinds of work on inclusion and accessibility, you know, some of the other things I think were really important. I mean, just a small thing, but I think also in 2013 or 2014, we had brought back audio description, which had been a thing that the theater had been doing that it had stopped. So we had done that. We had put in a hearing loop into the Sutton Theater because we had gotten a lot of feedback about people having a hard time hearing. And of course, you know, people have to be able to hear if they're going to enjoy theater. And so there had been a few things that had happened. And then another kind of milestone was being included in the Wake Arts Inclusion Project that Arts Access did that was funded by a grant from the John Rex Endowment, and that kind of gave us more of the capacity. And that's about all of the real specifics that my brain is able to, you know. Meredith is probably a much better person to talk about. Like, you probably remember a lot more about, like, well, when did we first start talking about it and why and all that kind of details, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to add to what you were saying, Charles, I think Johanna, your experience at James and the Giant Peach with Liam was really like the punctuating, oh, we are doing this, like, yeah, moment, because that was about a month after I started here. I came in March of 2017, and the sensory friendly performance of Alice at Wonderland that would later come to be the following spring was one of the first projects that Patrick had put on my plate of, like, call these people, meet, you know, make these contacts, like introduce yourself. And also this is a thing that you actually have a year to think about and like that we are going to be doing. I think I remember hearing about your and Liam's experience, Johanna, and just thinking like, I mean, it was just like, I mean, it would have given me a lot to think about kind of regardless, but I think just the layers of, you know, that relationship already being in place, like the relationship you had with the theater, that you are on our teaching staff, like, and it was your, like, just all the things, it was like, well, we are, you know, I hope we would hold ourselves accountable to any audience member, but I think it just like, that's one very concrete relationship that we can hold ourselves accountable to, and we can really kind of make good on making that more welcoming experience.
But what I love that you've done here is that it wasn't just kind of a one and done, check that box, you did it, now you can be done with it. What I love that you've done here is it's really part of this overall inclusive environment that you guys have created. Can you talk to me a little bit about this mindset and how you've made everything from your sensory friendly performances to even your classes more inclusive?
Yeah, I think the, you know, our goal with the initial sensory friendly performance of Alice in Wonderland, and certainly my goal kind of moving that project forward, was, you know, we need to document and create a relatively repeatable process so that it can be sustainable, so that it is, you know, we don't need a year to plan them now. Like we, you know, we kind of are recognizing like, oh yeah, it's about a month out. We need to do these things. And, you know, we're cultivating a group of volunteers that help support those performances and can come back and kind of know how it goes now. And what does volunteer training look like? And so all of these components that go into it. And the same thing really was influencing what we were working on in education. I think really a lot of it comes down to creating those communication pathways. So as the education director, working with our associate education director, you know, as the staff, we need to create and open up the communication lines between parents well before the camp or class starts so that we can try to gather just as much information as possible. And that information cannot and should not be limited to the accommodations needed, or I care less and less about what the diagnosis is and just more about what can we do to support your kid in our program. And also, what else should we know about your, what are they like? What are they interested in? You know, particularly folks I've met with autism tend to have some really strong interests. So if there are some strong interests that we can work into a theater game, or like that we can connect a teaching artist with, of like, hey, something you should know about so-and-so is they are super into dinosaurs or whatever, then we can just make it, it just helps us take a few more steps forward. And so connecting, sort of getting that initial gathering of information and connecting the teaching artist with it in advance as well, so that they can make any changes to their planning ahead of time. And then it's kind of just a reflective circle process throughout the week, throughout the class session of, you know, these things were tried, these things worked, these things we still have questions about or challenges with. So we want to just keep that communication loop going throughout.
So you start with Alice at Wonderland and then have a whole family series of shows that include sensory friendly performances. And now you get to this season and you're still having sensory friendly performances. But what's different this season is you also have Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which is a little bit different from those other shows because this show caters maybe to a little bit of an older audience, older children, teenagers. So from the sensory friendly performance perspective, because you are going to have a sensory friendly performance of Curious Incident, do the accommodations change because the audience might be a little bit different or older?
I don't think the accommodations so much change, but Curious Incident is an interesting example, and one thing that we're going to get to find out is how many changes do we make? Because one thing we've been discovering doing the family series ones is, you know, where possible, we don't want to make many changes to the show because this audience is here to see this show. So we want them to have what they need so that they can have as full an experience of it as possible. And now I would, you know, I think you could argue that Curious Incident is a show that was created for people who do not have sensory overload or sensory processing challenges. And so from what I know about the Broadway production, their technical elements, you know, are really trying to kind of create that experience for an audience that may not experience that in their life. And so then when you make a sensory friendly show of that, I think that's the question that we'll be kind of working on in a few weeks. When our consultant from the Autism Society, that she and I attend every preview, and then we kind of talk through, you know, just like, what are the concerns, what are the questions, whether it's about the space or show specific each time. So I think that will be the unique thing, but it will be another chance to do a sensory-friendly show in the Gatti, which we did for the first time last year.
And if people don't know, that's our smaller, more intimate black box studio.
Yeah, so it's a very different looking space, different set of challenges, different set of advantages, I think, too. And so it's a smaller house to begin with, but also the lobby's a different shape. And so kind of navigating, you know, we still have a quiet area in the lobby. We still have fidgets and headphones available. Thanks to some great volunteers who noticed that we were getting low on headphones, they have stocked us up. We have so many headphones. We're ready now. And yeah, and then we'll make the kind of, we'll probably still have the standard adjustment of having the house lights up at half, because that always helps reduce any contrast from the lighting cues that are in there. But, you know, we'll kind of have to, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, but I think that'll be an interesting one to do first.
And just to add to that, I think it's interesting, you know, that tour that started at the production, you know, was done at the National, it played on Broadway, it toured, came to DPAC, and you know, in a lot of ways, I think the other theaters in town would have liked to have gotten the rights to Curious Incident, but we just beat them to it. So sorry about that. But in any event, you know, a thing that Patrick and I talked a lot about putting it on the season, we did talk about putting it in the larger house, like in our 300-seat proscenium. And he and I were both really excited about the idea of putting it in a black box theater, partly because it's a way of really thinking about that show differently. Because what we didn't want to do is put it in a proscenium and then people be like, oh man, the special effects weren't quite as good as when it was at DPAC. Because obviously we're not going to do, you know, the moving scenery. And I mean, the projections in that show were incredible. It was beautiful, beautiful to look at. But so, you know, the way we ended up producing it kind of inherently, I think, it lends itself to sensory friendly better than, like, I'm not sure, did y'all see the tour? Yeah. Or I'm not sure how you would do a sensory friendly version of that production. There would be nothing left almost besides the script and a bare stage. So, you know, our production, now from talking with Patrick, there are a ton of lighting cues and sound cues. I think, like, we're talking hundreds of cues here. So it's not a technically simple show. But I think not having some of those technical, I mean, I'm interested in what y'all think. Yeah. Like, I know it's your interview, but your podcast, but I'm curious what you're curious about.
So I actually speak on this, and I do, you know, sensory friendly and relaxed performance. I have a book that I've created for theaters to use for all age and general audience productions, presented at the LEAD conference last year and SETC the year before that. And I use Curious Incident as an example of a poor choice to start if you're going to start relaxed performances and sensory friendly programming for adults, because of what Meredith said, that it is to give a neurotypical person the experience of sensory overload. So when I heard from Patrick that he wanted to not do that for this production, I was so excited and so hopeful, because as a prospective audience member and somebody who cares a lot about these types of performances, I think the audience is going to get something that's artistically equivalent to the regular production, and really thought about with inclusion in mind from the get-go, which again just gives me all the feels, and it makes me feel that RLT is the right place to do this production.
Another thing unusual about this production is that although the diagnosis of the main character Christopher is never specified in the book or even the show, it's understood that he is on the spectrum. And for this production, you cast an autistic actor in that role. So how has that been going? And just kind of FYI for our audience to know, this isn't a one and done thing for Raleigh Little Theater. You've cast actors with disabilities in non-disabled roles before, so that's not unusual, but it is unusual for this show to have an autistic actor playing the lead role.
Not to speak for Patrick, but kind of some of the thinking behind that comes from a main message in the disability in many communities of nothing about us without us, kind of thinking from that mindset, meaning that, you know, even I think it's very easy to be as an able-bodied neurotypical person myself, it would be easy to fall into the like, well, I'm doing a good thing. I'm intending for this to be good. But if I'm not accountable to another person with that experience that's different from mine, that, you know, then I'm limited of how much I can really understand and make sure that I'm doing something justice. So that's kind of, I think, something that we've been thinking about with this. And it was really interesting. I sat in on a few of the auditions. We had, 20, I think, individuals auditioned for this role.
And it was definitely a positive surprise so many kids were like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there were lots of choices. And I sat in on a few of the auditions just to be the other reader. And it was also really interesting to hear from them what they're connecting to about this character and what's resonating with them and what they were drawn to about it. And I think something that that I'm taking away from just kind of being near that casting process and working here is just thinking about how are we making those audition notices as accessible as possible. And a lot of it is like, just describe what you need the people to do, because it's not up to me to decide if someone can do something or not. That's up to them. Like, so make sure that you're, I think the message for organizations is making sure that you are as descriptive as possible, whether it's that your building requires use of stairs, whether it's like, you know, or naming some of the accommodations you are prepared to provide, such as like an alternate time or, reading it, getting sides ahead of time or large print materials, things like that, I think can be a way to signal like we're ready to work with you. We're ready to dialogue about what you need and how we can help.
And I'd love to affirm that in the autism community, you know, autistic is an identifier. It's part of an identity and it's a source of pride. And, you know, I'm trying to raise a proud autistic self-advocate if that's how he chooses to identify. And by saying that, hey, autistic is, this is my identity. And there might be some aspects of that that is disabling in certain circumstances. And to know that there is the infrastructure within the organization and within the production team to support those things as they come about, and that we're ready to listen to you and ready to hear you say what things are disabling for you and where you need those extra supports built in.
Charles and Meredith, in producing sensory friendly performances and creating an inclusive environment in your classes, casting actors with disabilities, has there been anything that surprised you in this journey?
I think the thing that comes to mind for me over and over again is while I find myself caught in kind of an overthinking space of, I just want to make sure everybody has what they need. And I wish I could anticipate every single need. Like, I don't care if it's 100 or 250 needs, like tell me what they are and I will try to anticipate them. But really it always surprises me, especially on the day when kind of the show's about to start or has just started and I'm looking around the house and I'm like, everybody, they have what they need or they have a way to get it. They know that the people in the yellow shirts are people they can ask. And really the thing that goes the furthest is not what kind of headphones or fidgets we have available or what our quiet space looks like or, whether we have beanbag chairs or not in it. It's not really about that. It comes back to a lot of what you were saying, Johanna, in your initial experience with Liam at the theater, is that it's about knowing that the other people that you're experiencing that theater with are cool with everybody being who they are and like all of that variety, and that kind of standard the standard kind of theater etiquette of like sit down, be still, be quiet, sit in the dark, it doesn't work for everybody and isn't and doesn't make it accessible. And that's a factor of the environment and of the experience that we can tweak, and we can lift that away for that performance and say if this performance would better suit your needs, where you're going to be surrounded by people who are totally fine with whatever sounds or movements your family member needs to make to express themselves, then like that's the thing that I'm like, that's the thing that goes the furthest that I see again and again, and that people respond to, and people can kind of, you know, exhale and relax and enjoy.
And we won't know what the potential is for a really long time when these children grow up and do what they're going to do with their lives. And they might say, hey, because I saw someone like me on stage at RLT, or hey, because I grew up taking classes there and got better and better and better, I'm an actor, or I have a career in the theater. We don't even know yet. And that's what's so exciting.
And so I wanted to finish this off, Johanna, and circle back around to you and ask, why are these sensory-friendly performances and experiences so important to families like yours?
We're an autism family and we're a theater family. And my son wants to act. He just finished up session 2 in creative drama. And like Meredith was saying, he's changed his name to Fox. He is all about foxes, wants to be a fox. And Miss Sherry in the class created a play for them to do where he could be a fox. And he got to keep his costume. And he was howling at the moon all night long. He's still performing Fox for us and can't wait to come back to session 3. So it's everything to a family like mine, to a family like ours, that he talks about Raleigh Little Theater as like his place, and he feels that sense of belonging. And I know we're just starting, you know. I can't wait for him to be in Teens on Stage and to do all those things that he wants to do. He's having the space that I dreamed for him and that he clearly wants to have.
The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime opens January 17th at Raleigh Little Theater. I'll be moderating a talk back with the cast after the January 26th performance, and there is a sensory-friendly performance scheduled for February 9th. More information can be found in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, become a patron of this program, follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.